Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 119. This is FDH Management Partner Rick Morris coming at you here today. And just the fact that it's been 119 mini episodes of this program since we took control of our own distribution last summer, that shows you how long it's been since we've had on this next guest, although he has been one of our most beloved recurring guests, and we've had some great political conversations with him. We actually got a chance to talk to him during the closing run of our full-length episodes, too. So it's been a while since we've had him on, but the segments that we've done together have been very, very memorable. It's great to be able to get a nice blend of analysis from him as well as his personal thoughts and takes and what he's rooting for on the political scene, because it tends to be different than, shall we say, than what I'm rooting for. But it's that nice blend of advocacy and analysis that we always get in our segments from him, much like what you find at epolitics.com, which is the website that he has been the proprietor of. And he has an excellent new ebook that is out, How Campaigns Can Use the Internet to Win in 2012. We'll certainly be talking about that today, as we are focused on the political scene in this very consequential election year. And as such, that is our cue to bring in, as I say, good friend of the show, Colin Delaney of ePolitics. Colin, how you doing, my friend? It's been too long. What's going on?
Hey, Rick, how you doing, man? It's great to be with you today.
Thank you so much, man. It's good to have you on. At the outset here, take a little minute here, talk about the ebook. I apologize that since I do not have a Kindle, I'm one of the freeloaders that got the PDF file, but for those who want a Kindle, that's available to be purchased for a tiny, tiny, tiny price as well here. But talk about all the stuff in here. I found it to be very enlightening about political technology in the 2012 election scene.
Well, Rick, I know you'll be shocked to hear that the free version outsells the paid version by about 19 to 1 the last time I checked the numbers, but that's no problem. It's all about spreading the word. I try to come out with these guides every major campaign season now, basically putting together a comprehensive overview of the tools that are out there, how to integrate them together, how to integrate them with TV, with grassroots work, with all the other things that a campaign does to get the most out of their time. And it's especially aimed at smaller campaigns, you know, state-level races, state legislative races, mayors, people that can't afford the big consulting firms. Because the big firms, you know, they do a fantastic job, a lot of them, but they also cost a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is to help the little guys.
Yeah, and this is the kind of thing that, yeah, can really help close the gap. If they have a resource like that, because, again, as you rightly point out, there are so many tools that are available out there to be exploited these days. I definitely want to talk some more on the ebook before we're done circling around here. But as far as the political scene goes, let's start with obviously the story of the last week or so here, the one that impacted the political campaign the most, and that being Barack Obama getting, I'd say, more or less smoked out by his own base on what I would say he truly believed all along. I mean, this is what the man said in 1996, and I don't think anybody believed he actually got more conservative on the position as time went by, but it happened. He got smoked out. My sense of it is, and by the way, to show that I'm not being a homer position here, I am not voting for Tweedledum or Tweedledummer. I am voting for former Congressman Virgil Goode on the Constitution Party line here. So I am not spinning for one side or another when I say this. My sense, Colin, I wonder if you agree, I think it's a narrow loser for Obama in the sense that, again, a lot of the PO'd lefties I know were already voting for the guy. There's a little bit more passion on that side. He sure got the rainbow ATM cards fired up. It's great for his contributions, you know, but beyond that, I look at it like there's a lot of people like me lifelong Roman Catholic, opponent of gay marriage, albeit a fan of Rudy Gay, I should say that in fairness here. Very bummed about Memphis going out of the playoffs yesterday. But, no, I think there's a lot of folks like me socially who voted for him last time, who overlooked the cognitive dissonance and or wanted to believe a certain thing here and now have been, you know, had it thrown back in their face that this is what the guy really stands for and he doesn't agree with you on opposition to gay marriage. So I don't think it's a big thing. In my estimation, he doesn't need to win Virginia or North Carolina. I think it really complicates his efforts in both and maybe a shade in the battleground states. What do you think?
Well, I think you're probably right. I think in the end, it's more of a wash than anything else. I'll tell you, his position had just frankly gotten to be untenable. I think you're absolutely right that nobody on the left really thought that he was against gay marriage. And he was getting so much pressure from these groups, and it was just frankly not consistent with the rest of his worldview.
Right.
And you know, one of the debates that's been going on around here is whether Biden was crazy or crazy like a fox, i.e., was that an official, unofficial trial balloon, or was Biden just speaking off the cuff and put Obama in a box? But if he did put him in a box, it's probably a box that he wanted to be in anyway. I'm on, you know, discussion groups with liberal activists and that kind of thing, and you know, there are a lot of people who weren't fired up a week ago who are fired up now, and I think it's going to make a big difference with the college students and with the people right out of school, because there's a massive demographic shift going on that people under 30, you know, by really large margins, just don't think gay marriage is a big deal. Speaking of North Carolina, I'll be very curious to see how different the electorate is in North Carolina in November. I mean, this was a special election. It was in May when college students are in finals and things like that. I'm wondering, you know, and just in general, special elections have a low turnout that tends to favor, a group that's fired up, and especially older people tend to vote more in specials. So a more Obama-esque coalition may show up in the fall. Now, one point that I thought was very interesting that someone made was, I believe it was in Slate.com, was that it may have been easier for Obama to come out in favor of gay marriage than it would have been for a white president, because one of the groups in the Democratic coalition that is pretty uncomfortable with gay marriage is church-going black people. But they're not
right.
going to turn against the first black president, where they might have turned against a white president.
You know, I agree with that. I guess my take on that is a much more cynical reading of what you just said there, and my sense being that church-going blacks who are opposed to gay marriage, ultimately when push comes to shove, if they're still voting for Obama, are putting racial identity above allegiance to God, in my estimation. How strong is your faith, frankly, if you're opposed to that? But, oh, well, first black president, gotta hang with him. I mean,
well,
are you opposed to it out of
a really considered belief, out of faith, or more just out of that's how you've always done things? I mean, Ecclesiastes says a lot of things. I don't stone witches either.
Interesting. Well, yeah, and that's, I mean, I guess I'm giving these people the benefit of the doubt on the one hand and not giving them the benefit of the doubt on the other side. Yeah, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt that they're opposed for reasons of religious faith, as I am. But, yeah, I would be very cynical, frankly, about anybody that was that big opposed to gay marriage still voting for Obama, because I would think that that's one of the more important social issues out there, to put it mildly. But that's a very interesting thought there about North Carolina and the electorate. I had not heard that point made previously, but I think that is definitely a good point as far as what the electorate's likely to look like in the fall. I have to say, again, I've thought all along that it was going to be more of a traditional map than last time. I mean, I don't think anybody, even on the Democratic side, is thinking Obama's going to win Indiana.
I think that's pretty much a given, my friend.
Well, yeah, exactly. But I didn't see him carrying North Carolina or Virginia anyways. Mm-hmm. I think I guessed his margin to be about 290, and that's about what I would say to this very day. But you keep hearing again that they think it's going to be maybe more of an untraditional map than last time, and that a lot of the red state blue state divide of 2000 and 2004 is going to be kind of out the window. How do you see it shaping up as of right now?
You know, it's really interesting because there are a lot of demographic shifts going on. And, you know, I live in the District of Columbia right next to Virginia. My younger brother lives down in Roanoke, which is very traditional conservative part of Virginia. I'm right next to Northern Virginia, which is multi-ethnic, which is high-tech oriented, and which is growing fast. Virginia is a changing state. And to a certain extent, North Carolina is too. I mean, North Carolina's population, I think the Hispanic population in North Carolina is getting up close to 10%. Now, a lot of them don't vote, but you can see the demographic shifts that are coming. There are the Dems, let's put it this way, if it's a traditional electoral map, Obama is going to have a tougher time. If it's an untraditional map, I think it's going to be untraditional because the Democrats are putting states in play that they used to not be able to. Does that make sense?
Well, that makes sense. And again, we don't know what the state of the economy is going to be by this fall. We don't know how events in Europe are going to shape this thing. I mean, there are so many things that could render aspects of this conversation obsolete even in the next 10 days with the state of the world these days. But without being too self-referential, I'd like to ask you a question here on a column that I wrote and that I had sent to you. And I got some of your initial thoughts.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was a great piece.
Well, thank you. It was a construct that I guess I've been playing around in my head for a long time, and it kind of just came to me. But this whole notion about really what's wrong with the conservative side of things and everything, I mean, I trace it back to the real cognitive dissonance about George W. Bush being president. I think, again, that these things that people would take as throwaway comments by George W. Bush about having, you know, gotten to be bigger than the conservative movement or replaced it with his form of, you know, quote-unquote compassionate conservatism, i.e. big government conservatism, I think the man needs to be taken at his word, because I think that that is exactly what happened, and I think that people are having a hard time processing it. And every time you point out, I mean, I get in arguments with my dad all the time, who's, you know, one of the frothing Obama email folks, and I say, hey, you can thank George W. Bush every day for giving us Obama, and my dad just doesn't want to hear it.
I think it's a true fact right there.
That is a central part of his legacy, so far as I can see, is that he gave us Barack Obama, and that's one of the reasons I have such disdain for his presidency. But it really is one of these things where it's a binary thing. I get this, and you probably see this with some of your friends on the right, that whenever, you know, anybody points out anything, well, whose side are you on? Whose side are you on? I get that all the time when I'm making these comments, and I think you commented back in an email to me that it seems to almost smack of tribalism, and I think that's quite right also.
Well, you know, one thing that I really liked about what you said, what really jumped out at me in that essay, was the sense that you can't just be against something. You have to be for something. And I think that's where a lot of liberal critics of Bush went wrong in the mid-2000s, was it was anti-Bush, but it wasn't pro-anything. And Obama came along, and he was pro something vague. He was pro hope and change, which could mean whatever you wanted him to mean, right? But he was for something. Where, you know, the people who were screaming about the war, I mean, many times they had very good points, but there needed to be some kind of alternative put out there. The same thing with the Bush tax cuts. There needed to be some kind of alternative put out there. And I think that what you're seeing now is, on the right, is this reflexive anti-Obamism or Obamaism. You can see it with the health care law. For instance, in 2010, a lot of these Republican Congress members ran on the idea of repeal and replace. But they haven't even introduced bills that would do any of that. All they are is anti-Obamacare. They're not pro anything that would address what, you know, any reasonable observer would say are problems in our healthcare system. You know, the costs are skyrocketing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That if they're not going to do anything other than just say no, what are you for?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. You know, and I would take it even a little bit further on that, because when you look at the opposition to Obama and the way that everything has gone down, really, and this is one of the things too, Obama in many ways has really just kind of doubled down on many central tenets of George W. Bush. If, like me, you hated George W. Bush's prolific at spending, well, you know, and I predicted this in 2008, it's going to be all the things that people hate and then some. Now, you may not completely agree with that point of view, but it's amazing how, you know, how many different aspects of Bushism. Now, I know that others on the left, Glenn Greenwald and some critics of the national security state,
absolutely,
say the same thing about Gitmo and other things like that. And,
but, no, there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people on the left who have been completely shocked at the extent to which, you know, there's another one. If I remember correctly, the Obamans have prosecuted more whistleblowers than the previous several administrations combined. And frankly, I don't think that's healthy. I you know, to me, that is worth going to the streets about, because, I mean, that is in the long run bad for, you know, the accountability of government.
Well, let me ask you this, and you know, turnabout's fair play, as I break my own side, or what's supposed to be my side, over the coals here. When you look at Gitmo's still open, which I actually applaud. I actually find to be refreshing pragmatism on Obama's part about some of the promises he made that I thought were a little bit fevered that he's walked away from. But things like that, things like the whistleblowers, things like the fact of how quickly he moved away from single payer. Isn't the tribalism also reflected in the fact that at not one point in the last 4 years has there been any notion of a major primary challenge to Obama? I mean, Jimmy Carter got challenged over his heresies, and other presidents as well, and there's not been a peep of any of that.
Actually, there has been a lot of a peep. You're just not listening to the channel
where
it's going on. Yeah, it's going on more behind the scenes. A lot of bloggers and activists have called for it. If you go back to the Carter example, I think it had less to do with – let's put it this way. I think it had more to do with Ted Kennedy's ego than it did with Carter's heresies. But
I would agree.
Also, it's just you know, Democrats don't want to do anything to screw this up, right? So, I mean, you may not like the guy, but you're not going to primary him. And the other thing is, what white politician is going to successfully primary the first black president in the history of the United States? Now, it's just a simple fact that the, you know, black vote is a very important part of the Democratic, you know, coalition, and no white president is going, you know, Hillary could successfully challenge him in the primaries, but no, once he is elected, nobody's going to go against him. Because it's just you're not going to win.
that's a good point. I mean, you know, white guilt alone is going to keep out any major Democratic challenge.
Well, it's just you think of who turns out in the Democratic primaries, and a good chunk of it is people who are fans of Obama. I mean, Obama's lost a lot of fans on the left, but plenty of people still are fans. And then you figure that black Democratic voters are going to turn out 90-95% for him. So you just don't really have a chance. It would be a lost cause, and no one would give you a dime.
Well, and this whole thing, too, and I don't think the Obama campaign is just blowing smoke about the comparisons that they see to 2004, because I see a lot of comparisons that favor him as well. I mean, you talked about it before when you picked up on my point about being for something. You know, maybe Mitt Romney should go ask a guy who lived in his state, you know, John F. Not Bush, how that turned out in 2004 about just being a repository of Bush hatred. I mean, you know, Mitt Romney is running as the pure repository of Obama hatred and pretty much nothing beyond that. I mean, the man will demagogue on anything. The man will bring up any point. There are even some folks on the left who, or on the right, who seem to be, or I guess it would be the anti-left if I'm going to be consistent in labeling this, who almost seem to be pro-childhood obesity just because Michelle Obama's against it. I mean, that just shows you the state of affairs.
Yeah, the obsession with eating your broccoli thing, I just have never quite understood. Like, for instance, she goes and gets a hamburger and Rush Limbaugh jumps on her, and you're like, well, she doesn't say all you have to eat is broccoli. You have to eat a balanced diet. It's good for you. Yeah, I know. It's a little but, you know, it was like the Clinton hate, you know, was it Clinton hatred disorder, whatever they called it back in the 90s. And then Bush gets it in the 2000s, and now Obama has it. A certain number of people are just going to go unbalanced. But, you know, a point I wanted to make during the gay marriage thing about Romney is, you know, it'll be interesting to see the extent to which Obama's decision, which I do think will fire up part of the left base, how much of it pushes evangelicals toward Romney, who might otherwise have stayed home because of the whole Mormon thing. You saw it in some of the coverage of the Liberty. I mean, I didn't really realize the extent of this. But when he spoke at Liberty University on Saturday, they interviewed several students, you know, who are evangelicals, and several of them were going to support Romney. But others really felt that Mormonism was a cult, felt very strongly about that. And that's a strange, that's like a set of beliefs in the evangelical community that, that I'm not really exposed to much. And I wonder if, you know, how much that's going to matter. The gay marriage thing may really help him with that slice of the electorate.
Well, Colin, I wasn't really aware of it either, but and what I'm going to say is going to be taken as controversial, but I'm just repeating something that I know. A very close friend of mine, his father was, the polite word would be recruited, but probably the more accurate word would be indoctrinated into joining the Mormon Church. I was like most people, and you probably were too. Oh, ho, goofy kind of a thing. Oh, you know, no alcohol, no caffeine, funny underwear, ha, harmless people. Then you find out these things, and like, ooh, okay. So, yeah, I mean, I look at things in a different light since I heard that, and that is something that he is having to battle. And is that a part of my reason that I'm staying away? Not completely, because I find the man to be a complete untrustworthy weather vane, but is that part of my calculus? I'm going to be honest, if stupid, and say yes. So I'm sure
very
that's
interesting.
The case with
okay.
Other- Yeah, I'm gonna. I think for other people, that's going to be an issue also.
Yeah, and again, I don't think it's going to be, you know, like it's going to be a major thing that's talked about in public, but it might be one of those subtle little things that suppresses turnout a few points here and there. I mean, it's not going to lose in South Carolina. Let's put it that, you know, put it that
right.
way. But you look at a state like Colorado, which the Democrats would really like to take this time, it has a significant Mormon population. So it's liable to help him in a place like that.
That's true, and I'll tell you this too. My brother, who lives in the South, has pointed out to me anecdotally over the course of the last year or two a very strong campaign of billboards coming up of, hey, you know, Mormons, we're people just like you.
Uh-huh.
There's been some kind of orchestrated kind of a campaign over a period of time. Now, you could take the benign view of that and say, look, they knew that there was going to be more scrutiny of the church.
Yeah.
They're trying to put on a good face in advance. That's the benign way of looking at it. There are also less benign ways of looking at it under the circumstances as well. So, yeah, these are issues that are going to be part of the campaign as it gets hotter, no question.
But I think you're right that the Romney is weather vane. Romney is a man of no real convictions. That is the main thing he's going to have to fight, because that's what's going to – I mean, that there are a lot of conservatives who aren't going to like that, you know, that didn't like him. I mean, he still, you know, late in the primary season was still getting, you know, relatively low percentages compared to what you might expect for somebody who was by then inevitable. And then with the sort of the swing voters, it'll be interesting. You know, a man who makes a $10,000 bet on stage, it's just kind of hard for an everyday dude to relate to him. You know, by this point, Obama is also a millionaire, right, from his book sales and nothing else. But you know that he came up a normal guy, with a Kenyan father growing up in Hawaii. But, you know, it wasn't like he was going to a private school.
Right. No, I mean, you know, that's the issues of where each of those two guys came from are kind of baked into the cake also in the perceptions. But, you know, I wonder in terms of looking this, and by the way, and again, as far as that goes, you mentioned, you know, the Kenyan background, Hawaii and everything like that. And when we talk about birtherism and some of the kind of fever swamp things that have been around, I've always sensed, and this may be a little bit paranoid, but I've always sensed that Obama is the rare politician that uses a dog whistle to his enemies, not to his friends. I think that Obama, I think for as long as he dragged his feet in putting out the birth certificate thing, I think it was only when Trump began to really draw blood that he went and put it out. But I get the sense on that and with gay marriage and some of these other things here that he is doing things that again, I'm not absolving anybody on the anti-left for their, you know, fever swamp type stuff. But I get the sense that Obama is smart enough to get these people riled up, and that he knows exactly what he's doing and fueling these things. Is that paranoid, or could there be a strain of truth to that?
Possible, but, you know, I think it is so hard to try to predict in advance how anything is going to play out. And honestly, I think in 2008, the biggest danger he had was this Obama is an alien, you know, alien to our way of life sort of meme. And it was getting spread through lots of vicious emails and that kind of thing. You know, it wasn't talked about as much in public. It was, and, you know, to John McCain's credit, he pushed back against some of that. I don't know. I don't think Obama would intentionally play with fire in that way because the danger of blowback is too great. I think they just thought it was flat out stupid. And it was a joy to watch Trump be made to look like a fool.
Well,
he was a clown. I mean, he was an embarrassment to the Republican primary process that anybody took him seriously.
Well, again, Trump's another guy like Romney, and it's no wonder they're friends now that, you know, whatever's advantageous politically is a point that he's going to put out there. All right, well, even if it's not an overt thing, I've always thought that at least in some ways they shared some responsibility for it. It's because, again, he was pitching, I think, the flip side of that other coin to the kids. He was selling to the kids, I'm different, I'm unlike anything you've ever seen before. I think if you're doing that, and as you said before, allowing some blanks to be filled in as a deliberate matter of course, as a good politician's going to under the circumstances, I mean, I think to a certain extent, when you're running so hard as the positive side of the other, I think you can buy a little bit of the other side coming back your way, too.
No, I see what you're getting at. I hadn't really thought about it from that point of view, but I can see what you're getting at. But I do think that they recognize the danger that that could have killed them with, you know, sort of middle America voters who were not as comfortable with the new. But no, unfortunately, you know, we'll never really know.
No, it's true.
That's the hassle.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing here. In our remaining minute or two, let's turn it back around again here. Again, to the ebook that you've got out there, and as you said, you've tried to do this regularly over the course of time as these campaigns are coming up, and you know this one specifically that you've got out there, both in PDF form and in Kindle form, how campaigns can use the internet to win in 2012. You talked about a little bit of how this can be especially beneficial to smaller scale campaigns, but what are some of the other things that people should have as a takeaway for this book, Colin?
That basically you want to go where the voters are and communicate with them through the channels they use. There's so many different ways. Well, and another big thing is you don't want to get distracted by the new and the shiny. You really want to focus on what is going to turn voters out on election day. Because a campaign can't waste resources. The most important resource they have is time, right? They cannot waste any of that. And somebody who's pitching you some idea of how they think things ought to be really ought to look at what people are using across the country, what's actually working. And what's working is advertising online. What's working is email fundraising. What's working is video for persuasion. And I think we're going to see a lot of mobile websites and mobile applications for cell phones for field organizing, for field canvassing, going door to door. It's going to be fascinating to watch. And the one thing that's interesting is the tools don't care who uses them, right? So the Republicans have just as much chance this year on the technological front as the Democrats. It's going to come entirely down to how well they actually use the stuff.
That's true. That's true. And, you know, for as big of a Karl Rove critic as I am, back in the early days of Bush, Republicans actually were ahead in a lot of the key ways technologically. That pendulum kind of swings back and forth. It's been on the Democrat side the last couple of years. But as you say, there's nothing that indicates that one side or another is going to have permanent dominance there. So, again, Colin, this is a perfect illustration of why you are one of our favorite guests to have on. Always enjoy breaking it down with you, sparring and analyzing and all of that stuff. I'm sorry we missed you in person at South by Southwest here, but definitely look forward to having you back on repeatedly as things materialize.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Colin. Appreciate it. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. FDH Lounge mini episode number 119.